After all, this was an area where people had developed an insatiable craving for boats. Big, big boats. Even though the nearest water was 100 miles away. But it was still hard to predict the success or failure of the new Rolls-Royce dealership. The country was in the midst of a recession in the summer of 1980, and interest rates were close to 20%. But that didn't matter. Even before the dealership opened, it had made about 17 sales for its line of cars, which ranged in price from $85,000 to $200,000. A year and a half later, the Rolls-Royce dealership was barely noticed. "We're experiencing a transition from a town to a city," said I. David Porras, a developer who tooled around in a Learjet with red leather seats and painted black on the outside. Porras announced plans for a 54-story office building. The First National Bank of Midland announced plans for 2 40-story-plus bank towers. MGF Oil Corporation also announced that it was entering into a venture to build a 40-story-plus world-class luxury hotel to be designed by I.M. Pei. In 1982, according to one report, the value of non-residential construction that had been legally permitted in Midland led the state of Texas, even ahead of Dallas and Houston, both of which were undergoing incredible booms of their own. The 3.2 million square feet of office space actually under construction in Midland was equivalent to the amount in San Antonio, Fort Worth, and Austin combined. The population of these towns was 22 times that of Midland. As real estate was booming, so was banking. The First National Bank of Midland, the great financial and moral beacon of the town for over 90 years, its $1 million corporate art collection with works by Thomas Moran and Norman Rockwell, the essence of conservative good taste, had suddenly become a casino 10 times grander than anything in Atlantic City or Vegas. Junior officers were making loans of up to $1 million without any review. Careful checks of collateral became almost laughable and utterly contrary to the ultra-competitive machismo attitude that pervaded the banking industry in Texas. One of First National's highest-ranking officers wasn't above taking undisclosed interest in some of the ventures in which the bank lent money. As it turned out, the reckless freewheeling ways of the First National Bank of Midland made it a trendsetter in the American banking industry during the 80s. In 1980 and 1981, the assets of the bank had more than doubled in size to $1.6 billion, and loans tripled as well to $1.1 billion. The bank, the 205th largest in the country in 1976, was the 115th largest by the middle of 1982, and the largest independent bank in the state of Texas. In February 1982, the bank's economic research arm estimated a 13% increase in the number of oil rigs and concluded, based on careful consultation with the country's leading economic experts, that the price of oil would increase at least as fast, if not faster, than general U.S. inflation for the next 10 years. It was around this time that Aaron Giebel had begun work on his house, although calling it a house was the same as describing the Statue of Liberty as a figurine. It really wasn't a house at all, but a private kingdom. Initially, his wife was against building it, but Giebel pushed it because it was a wonderful symbol in a part of the country where subtlety was owning an 8-seater prop instead of a Lear. It was, as he said, a salute to our success. The 13,000-square-foot house had a pool, a tennis court, a gazebo, 2 jacuzzis, a workout room, 10 bathrooms, and a special wing with a video room for his 7 grandchildren. It cost $2.4 million. Along with the other things going on in Midland, the trip to Palm Beach that one oilman had sponsored for himself and several hundred of his friends in a chartered 747, the announcement that the Rolls-Royce dealership had received a Silver Lady Award for being one of the 3 top Rolls dealers in the United States. Giebel fitted comfortably into the rhythm of things. And then it had ended. Just like that. Not with a warning, not in a way so that those who got caught had only themselves to blame. One day the lights were on, the next day they were off. Demand for oil began to slacken significantly in 1982, and the result was a glut. "The price just dropped off the side of a building," said Giebel. "We were like children." I said, "Oh, my God, it can't stay like this. It can't really be happening. The situation will rectify itself." Almost as soon as Aaron Giebel had finished his house, he knew he was going to have to sell it to meet cash flow problems. And it was hard to remember a worse day in his life than the one when he turned to his wife and simply said, "This thing's got to go." He sold it without ever moving into it, at a loss of $700,000. In a year, from the end of 1981 to the end of 1982, his empire was in ruins. Thousands of other empires were in tatters also, including that of the seemingly untouchable bank that had financed him. At the end of 1981, a record 4,530 drilling rigs were running in the United States. 10 months later, that number had dropped to 2,379. The First National Bank, which had dished out loans as freely as a doctor gives out lollipops, was in grave trouble. In July and August 1982 alone, deposits had dropped $150 million. An examination was quietly begun by the office of the Comptroller of the Currency off the bank premises to preclude local panic. Every day, credit files were flown from Midland to Dallas, where examiners pored over the loans. The examination, done in the summer and fall of 1982, turned up startling news. $108 million in loans, 8% of the total, was overdue. $357 million in loans, 26% of the total, did not have sufficient documentation. To the examiners, the situation was crystal clear. The bank had become a running crap game. The bank, which on its 75th anniversary had received a resolution from the Texas State Senate congratulating it for its active, aggressive, and effective role in the community, became an example of all that had gone terribly wrong. The town's mightiest symbol suddenly found itself on its knees because of the blindness of its greed and its utter lack of caution. In the bank's dire need for cash to keep it afloat, everyone became a potential pawn, even its best, most loyal customers. They trusted the bank blindly, stupidly, as it turned out. When asked to jeopardize millions of dollars of their own money to keep the bank going, they did so, still rooted in the ethos of the 50s, when you just gave help with no conditions attached when a friend asked for it. But this was the 80s, when nothing was sacred, except, of course, the making of money and the protection of glasshouse empires at all expense. At the end of 1982, the bank, desperate to show a profit, proposed a whirlwind deal to sell its headquarters to a partnership of 7 customers for $75 million. These men, either personally or through their companies, had over $200 million in loans from the bank. The way the deal was structured, they would be able to do it without putting up any significant amount of cash, and there might also be some nice tax advantages in it. Beyond that, all of them felt a certain amount of moral indebtedness to the bank since it had helped them make their fortunes. Several of those who signed promissory notes did so without reading the paperwork. "Come on, you know me better than that," oil man Tom Brown, who had $160 million in loans from the bank through his company and had executed 3 promissory notes for $6.25 million, told a lawyer in subsequent court testimony. "I didn't read any papers. I wanted to get back home for one reason. It was New Year's Eve." The bank used the alleged profits from the sale to show a profit in 1982 of $11.9 million instead of a loss. The Securities and Exchange Commission later said that those figures were false and misleading, in part because the sale price for the headquarters had been overvalued by as much as $40 million. But for the time being, the First National Bank was still afloat. In June, however, the results of another examination by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency showed that 39% of all of First National Bank's loans were in trouble. The bank was dying, but still the people of Midland and even Odessa refused to believe it. There was an air of unreality to it all, as if the situation would somehow, some way, magically fix itself. In the backs of people's minds, there had to have been days during the boom when they looked out at their world, a world so drenched in materialism that even Ronald Reagan might have gasped and wondered when, like a stage set, it was all going to disappear, when the Lears and the Rolls Royces and the 18th century antique desks would eventually have to go back into their boxes. But never in a thousand years did anyone in Midland, in Odessa, in all of West Texas ever think that the bank would crumble. Sure, it would take a few hits, just like everyone else did, but if anything could withstand the bust, it would be the First National Bank, the institution that had made Midland unique and had set its course from the very beginning. "It was more important than the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost," said attorney Warren Burnett. "They truly thought it was untouchable." But as for many other institutions in the 80s, greed overcame history. On Friday evening, October 14, 1983, at 6:13 p.m., the First National Bank was declared insolvent by the Comptroller of the Currency. In terms of the size of assets, the bank's failure was second largest in U.S. history. When the First National Bank of Midland went down, it certified not only that the boom had ended, but that a way of life had ended. Its failure was a precursor to the falls that would later inevitably take place all over the country, on Wall Street in New York and State Street in Boston. "It was like dropping an atomic bomb on a town," said former mayor Hank Avery, and the explosion was felt in Odessa. For perhaps the first time ever, there was no gloating over the misfortunes of Midland. "It was frightening," said Lenita Akins. "It brought you back to reality and made you realize that the boom was over and that it wasn't going to turn around the next day. I remember gasping for breath." But Aaron Giebel, who had been forced to file for corporate bankruptcy when the bank had foreclosed on several of his oil properties, had a different view of it. A view colored by his own experiences, but also by the craziness of the times that he had lived in. "There is no question the banks were tantamount to prostitutes during the boom," he said, recalling how representatives of banks all over the country had called up begging to do business with him. Several years later, federal judge Lucius Bunton compared the First National Bank to the Titanic. "The First National Bank, like the vessel, was a magnificent, extravagant, enviable Camelot," he wrote in an opinion in a case involving the bank. "It was regarded as unsinkable, said to be designed and engineered to withstand the formidable forces of natural laws. The bank, like the liner, was doubly supported, tightly compartmental. If one of its parts were weakened or damaged, the other sections were designed to keep it afloat." It was a wonderful analogy, not only for the bank, but for all of Midland. For 8 years, the whole area had been like the Titanic, a raucous, crazy ship equipped with every possible amenity, towering atop the nubby, gnarled brown sea of West Texas, its passengers dining every night at the fabulous first-class restaurant where between bottles of $150 wine, they pulled out their wallets to show off laminated pictures of their jets and rigs and Brangus bulls, so caught up in the revelry and merriment that they forgot it was still a dangerous, unpredictable world out there, over which they had no control. Did Aaron Giebel see the iceberg looming as he built his San Simeon and dreamed his dream of cows strong enough to pull buildings? Did Tom Brown, as he took out $160 million in loans and signed promissory notes for $6.25 million without reading the paperwork? Did any of the hundreds of others who had expanded beyond all imagination? Of course not. Should they have? Maybe it wasn't the Titanic at all, but just a ship of fools turned mad by money and greed. If Aaron Giebel was thankful for anything, it was that his son Mark had been there to witness the terrifying things that oil and money could do to a man. "I thank God that my son has been in here," said Giebel. "He has seen all this, and thank God he's not going to succumb to it." Part 4. In the fall of 1988, Midland and Odessa were still in the doldrums of the bust. Nothing quite as dramatic as the sinking of the First National Bank of Midland had taken place for some time, but by then, people had become immune to catastrophe anyway. In July 1986, the nation's rig count hit an all-time low of 663, some 85% fewer than the high it had hit less than 5 years earlier. At the same time, the wellhead price of U.S. oil dropped to $9.25 a barrel. There was some slight improvement afterward, but not enough to make a difference. The oil production industry in West Texas had collapsed. People had been drilling for oil in the Permian Basin for over 60 years. They had punched thousands of holes into the scrubby earth, and some believed it was only a matter of time before the place got tapped out. Unlike the Middle East, where oil almost literally flowed out of a spigot, finding it here was getting harder and more expensive. The days of the great gushers had been gone for years. It took extensive drilling to find what was there, and the yields were not enormous. When the price of oil had been high in 1980 and 1981, it was worth the cost. But when the price dropped, the frantic search for oil in the Permian Basin and all of Texas quickly became much less attractive. In 1987, the amount of oil produced in North America had actually been the same as the amount of oil produced in the Middle East, about 12.5 million barrels a day. But it took nearly 675,000 wells to produce that amount in North America. In the Middle East, it took about 4,500. The bust had extracted a terrible toll, and the list of people and institutions that had been destroyed read like a horrible casualty list. 6 banks had failed. 10 bankers had been convicted of criminal activities ranging from embezzlement to fraud and received prison sentences as high as 24 years. Hundreds, big and small, had filed for bankruptcy, and many more were still trying to extract themselves from the rubble of houses they couldn't sell and creditors they were trying to pay off. All around were signs of what was and now wasn't. Office buildings of darkened glass in downtown Midland and Odessa that were virtually empty and had the scent of unopened boxes. Streets where 3/4 of the houses were for sale. Warehouse lots filled with beautiful new rigs that had never been touched. There may not have been a more awesome graveyard in the country than the old MGF lot off Highway 80. 30 acres filled with equipment that had cost $200 million and in the fall of 1988 might have fetched $10 million. With 300,000 feet of new and used drill pipe up on metal stilts like pixie sticks, 400 drill collars, and the guts of 19 rigs. In its heyday, MGF Drilling had had about 1,200 people working for it and about 55 rigs. Then the bust came, and MGF bloated from $121 million in loans from the First National Bank was finished. It had filed for bankruptcy and was bought out by another company, Parker and Parsley, for virtually nothing. The man in charge of the yard, Don Phillips, pointed to Rig 79, a 25,000-foot beauty that was built for $9.5 million in 1982 and had never been used.